This is the first in a series of classes covering the basic teachings of Soto Zen Buddhism. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of Zen and what the practice is. And then I'm going to cover some of the basic teachings. And some of these things you will have heard about, and they can get very confusing, like the word emptiness. Maybe some of you have heard that. Or the teachings of no self. Or Buddha nature. Bodhisattva. What is faith in Buddhism? All of these things come up when we start engaging with Soto Zen. So, as with the beginning chant, this isn't meant as an intellectual exercise. This is a class, a talk. This is going to be, we're going to be reviewing things. We're going to be thinking about things. We're going to be thinking about how we ask questions of things, right? But it's not just intellectual. It's about tasting the truth of these teachings, about letting them penetrate into our bodies and hearts. So the other thing I want to say is that the study of Zen should never be tense or grim. Okay? We should have enjoyment of this. When you taste a good meal, it's just enlivening. One of my teachers went to Italy once, and he said he realized in Italy the table is the center of the universe. You know, so that's what we're cultivating, is that feeling of pleasure, of enjoyment, of investigation. Yes, it can be rigorous. We can think about things. We can ask hard questions. It can be a little bit uncomfortable sometimes. You know, I read this book called Bringing Up Bebe about raising children in France. Have any of you read this book? It's a delightful book for many reasons. But one of the things they do in France is from a very young age they train people's palates. Little kids are stretched a little bit in there. They put a lot of effort into the food they serve in schools, and they introduce children at a very young age to things that maybe they're not so comfortable with. There's a little bit of a stretch there, so they educate their palate. They educate themselves and challenge themselves, and that's what we're doing. We're challenging ourselves a little bit, but it should be an enjoyable process, not grim, not tense. We're going to talk about rituals and forms. We have a lovely altar here that was made by one of our dear friends and Sangha members. We have a Buddha up there. We don't put our coffee cups on the Buddha, on the altar, but there are no lightning bolts that are going to come down and zap you if you get the forms wrong, okay? This is really important. So it's a feeling of respect and investigation, and also a feeling of warmth and ordinariness. So there's a connection to our joyful heart. Dogen, who I'll talk about, you know, talks about the four minds that we should cultivate. And one of them is the joyful mind. So we have to bring that in. The other thing is we have to have a sense of humor. We have to be a little bit irreverent. A little bit pokey. The thing that's important to know is that the teachings can stand up to any questions that you have. They're very sturdy teachings. In fact, fearless questioning is a part of Soto Zen practice. That's part of what we do, is we ask, what is this? We ask questions. So don't hold back. Okay? Don't swallow your questions. Don't think there are stupid questions, because I can guarantee you, if you have a question, probably somebody else in the room does too. In fact, some of the questions that seem so simple are the most profound. They're the ways in which we really get at the truth of the matter. There's a story about Huineng, who was the sixth patriarch, and when he was a boy, he heard the Heart Sutra, which I'll talk about in a little bit. And the Heart Sutra says, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. And he was apparently just about 6 or 8 years old, and he said, but I have a nose. I have a tongue, so what could that teaching mean? That kind of question seems so simple, doesn't it? But it's like really gets to the heart of the matter. Like what is this teaching? What does this actually mean for me? I have a nose. I have difficulty. My mind wanders. I'm not always kind. What's that about then? So this is what we, this is the spirit of what we're going to do. This is the spirit that we're going to engage in. Okay? Did you all sign on to that? Ready? Ready. Okay, good. So, I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think Zen is? Sue, could you turn that? Fearlessness, remember, somebody has to say something. We'll sit here.
Something popped into my head, I have no idea why.
Okay, good.
Study of no mind.
Study of no mind, okay.
I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, good. How does a mind study with no mind? Okay, anybody else?
Simplicity.
Simplicity. That's great, yeah. Yeah. What does that, you know, what does that mean? Because we complicate our lives all the time, yeah.
I think letting go is a good one that we hear so often. Mm-hmm. You know, what does that really mean?
You know, I think I might be the only person on the planet that hasn't heard that song from Frozen that apparently all the kids are singing. Isn't it Let It Go? Let It Go? Yeah, I keep thinking I have to go, like, go find it somewhere and listen to it, because I keep hearing the parents, like, up to their parents of young children. So, letting go. Yeah, and who lets go? What does that mean?
Yeah. Impermanence.
Impermanence. Good one. Yeah, we'll be talking about that in a bit. How do we live with that? How do we actually live with that? Yeah.
Staying present.
Staying present. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interdependence.
Interdependence? Yeah. Means we're never alone.
How about a religion from another country?
Oh, that's a good one, too. That's very good. It is. It's a religion from another country. It is a religion, by the way. Religion meaning, guiding principles that guide us. Religion just doesn't have to do with God. It has to do with how we live our lives. There's a wonderful fellow named James Fowler. He wrote a book called Stages of Faith. And he asks these really terrific questions in the beginning. And one of them is, what are you living and being lived for? What are you living and being lived? He calls faith entering the force, the guiding principles as we enter the force field of life. Isn't that good? So, yeah, a religion from another country.
Mm-hmm. Practice.
Practice. Yeah, great. Practice. And we're going to talk about what is that? Because a lot of times people think practice has to do with just meditating, right? And Soto Zen has a very particular way of talking about meditation. But to practice Soto Zen happens in every aspect of our life, not just sitting on the cushion. So to say, I'm going to go practice now, I say, well, you're going to go cook dinner? You know? You're going to go take your dog for a walk? You're going to go listen to your coworker cry? What are you going to do? So, yeah, practice. Practice at the heart of it. Anybody else? How about sitting in a small room together?
I was going to say, for me, it's the experiencing what I'm aware of in the moment for being just that.
Very good.
And nothing more.
Yeah, and nothing more. And how easy is that? Not, you know, this is, we get back to simplicity, right? We say, just experiencing just this. You know, it's like we say, in Zen we say, just this is it. Really? Just this? Does somebody else need to sit someplace? There's a back jack here.
We need a chair.
We need a chair. Are there any other?
There's one place in here for someone. We can all move over.
And there's a chair over here.
And there's a chair right here. Thank you very much for doing that. We'll figure out something for next week that's a little. We'll scrounge up some more chairs and things. Hi, Holly. Okay, these are great questions. This is where we start. These are great comments. This is where we start kind of poking around. One of the things I like to say about studying Zen is, we circumambulate the teachings. To circumambulate is to circle something that's holy, right? We circumambulate the teachings. We never stop. As long as we live, we keep going around the teachings. It's endless. It's an endless study. Another image that's often used in Buddhist teachings is what's called Indra's net, which is a net, like a fishing net, and in each place where there's a join, there's a jewel, and each jewel reflects every other jewel. So when we pick up one part of the teachings, we pick up the whole net, and everything is reflected. So we have to be willing to be to have partial knowledge, and we have to be willing to be surprised, and we have to be willing to hold contradictions, and just be humble in the presence of the teachings and investigate them. So let's talk a little bit about practice. That's where I want to start, because Soto Zen is all about practice. Thank you, Sandy. It's all about practice. It's all about engaging in our lives as they are at this moment and being awake to what is. Does that sound familiar to any of you? Yeah. Zazen happens in all, practice happens in all aspects of our life, but Zazen is central. The practice of Zazen is central. Zazen, work practice, relational practice, how you get along with people. You know, my teacher would say, you know, you'd go in and you'd say something about your Zazen, and he'd say, how's it going at work? What's happening with your neighbors? How's your kitchen look? Yeah? So, relational practice, including the teacher-student relationship, we'll talk a little bit about that. The precepts, which are the guiding moral principles of our lives, forms and rituals that we do, bows, and we chant things, and we have ways that we relate to objects. Very important, how we relate to objects. And study. So all of these express and confirm the way of Soto Zen. And as we go through the teachings, each of these forms express the teachings in a certain way. They kind of release the teachings to us. So when we put our hands in gassho, something happens. You know, we have an experience of that. When we study, when we are kind to someone, the teachings are released in that moment. They come forward. So we're going to study things kind of, teachings of emptiness. But the teachings actually come to life in practice. Without practice, we can't really know the teachings. But study can help us know our lives in a certain way. In Zazen, we're still and alive in this moment. That's what Zazen is. At work, we tend to respect all aspects. situation. In relationship, we express deep intimacy and care and respect, a kind of mutuality with all beings. In the precepts, we honor and hone our ability to be awake and responsive. Right? We're guided. We have something that guides us. Oh. Disciple of the Buddha does not steal. What does that mean? We'll talk about that. Not to kill. What does that mean? How do we actually live that out in this complicated world? In study, we grow in our ability to integrate and express the teachings. We feed ourselves. Nourishment, good nourishment. Just to borrow from another religion, from another country, but a European country, Saint Benedict said we should eat the teachings so much that when we belch the teachings. Again, we have this kind of visceral way of thinking of things, right? This body, tasting, eating. So let's start with a little history. First thing to know is that Zen is Buddhist. It's part of Buddhism. Sometimes people think it's some other thing out there, but it's not. It's completely grounded in Buddhism and the Buddhist teachings. It's not different. It's a specific reflection of those teachings, as are many others, but it is grounded in the basic Buddhist teachings. So, many of you know, Buddha was born 2,500 years ago in India. And there's a whole story about his early life as a person of privilege. They say a prince, the son of a chieftain, but he was wealthy in the terms of those days. He was protected. And he followed a longing. He left the palace and he encountered old age, sickness, death, and a mendicant. These are sometimes called the four heavenly messengers. Old age, sickness, and death are heavenly messengers. But what he did when he encountered them was he didn't turn away. He didn't go back to the palace and have a beer. He actually was drawn into his own life with questions of, what is this old age? What is this sickness? What is death? What is this human life? And when he saw a mendicant, a traveling monk, and there were many of them, traveling teacher, ascetic, he left and he followed ascetic teachings and he learned a lot, but it didn't satisfy. It didn't satisfy his basic question. And so he took nourishment in the form of sweet milk from the hand of a maiden. This was really breaking the rules for an ascetic. And he sat under the bow tree and he said, I will sit here until I see things as they are. And by the light of the morning star, he woke up. He woke up to the way things are. All beings in that moment woke up. Yeah. In the course of the night, he was challenged by the principles of delusion, with all versions of things to knock him off his seat. And the final one was Mara, it's called Mara, the expression of delusion, said, what right have you to sit here? Who do you think you are? What right have you to think you can wake up? Have you ever thought that? Have you ever thought, it's just me, I get cranky, and I'm not always so nice, I sit down and my mind wanders. Have you ever thought, not me. I can't wake up. I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not brave enough. I'm not poor enough, I'm not beautiful enough, I'm not fill in the blank, right? And what Buddha did was he touched the earth. He didn't argue. He didn't try and convince. He didn't trot out his credentials. He just touched the earth. And the earth bore witness to his right to sit there. And this is what we must do. We must touch the earth. That's what we do when we practice. We touch the earth. We remember who we are. When we sit down, we remember who we are. We're not fooled by the stories that we concoct about who we are, who we aren't, what we should be, how we, blah, 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 blah. So then the Buddha began to teach. He actually, not right away, didn't teach. He was actually begged by the gods to teach. Please go out. There are only some people with little dust in their eyes. And there are many teachings that grew from him, from his teachings at that time. There were, and Buddhism, as you can imagine, over 2,500 years, has developed many different philosophies and schools, and people argue with one another, and there's, you know, so it's very complex history. Many philosophical systems, versions of monastic life, versions of lay life, all kinds of things. But they're all family. They're all related to the core Buddhist teachings. So there are many, you know, streams that were in Indian Buddhism. And different streams were carried to different parts of the world. There were teachings that traveled to China and then to Japan and Korea and Tibet. And there were other teachings, versions that traveled to Southeast Asia, to Burma, Thailand, Laos, that area. Okay. The teachings that were there and are there are generally called Theravadan teachings. And I'm not going to go into a lot of differences. But the current Vipassana practice that many of you might be familiar with grew out of that version of Buddhist teachings. The teachings that went to China and Japan and Korea are generally called the Mahayana. So I say this not to get into philosophical, but just to say there are differences. So if you hear one version of the Dharma here and another version of the Dharma there, and they sound like they don't completely add up, it's because they don't. They're differences. And we can enjoy one of the benefits and the confusions of our contemporary life is that we can hear all these different versions of Buddhism. We can say, but this one says this, and this one says this, and this one says this, so which one's right? They're all right. They're all versions. And what your job is to listen to them as deeply as you possibly can and to enact them in your life and see what works for you. There's a Kalama Sutta, early Buddhist teachings, in which Buddha goes to a village in which there's all these people, all these teachers are visiting, it's at a crossroads, and they say to him, well, which one's right? Which of these teachings is right? And he says, what works? What's wholesome? What actually engages you to be, I'm saying this, but, to be kinder, to be more settled, to be more awake. Test it out. Test it out. If it works, do it. If it doesn't, don't. So I'm going to be presenting these Soto Zen teachings to you, and I want you to understand they're in a big universe of Buddhist teachings. In China, there became what's called Chan Buddhism. Buddhism traveled to China and encountered Taoism, and some people say that what was born there was Chan. Chan means jhana, which means meditation. And when that word chan went to Japan, it turned into Zen. Okay? So that's the word Zen is a Japanese version of chan, and chan is a Chinese version of jhana and what we mean meditation. So it's a school of meditation. It's a school of people who value sitting meditation. So there's many schools even of chan. And in Japan, there are two primary schools. Rinzai, which is koan. Have you all heard of koan? What is the sound of one hand? What was your face before your mother was born? Things like that. Those are koans. And Rinzai Zen focuses a lot on koans and koan crippling. And Soto Zen focuses on what's called shikantaza, just sitting. Just sitting. Soto Zen is sometimes known as peasant Zen. Rinzai Zen is more samurai, right? Elite, intellectual. A lot of need for intellectual study, for knowing poetry. It's a venerable, beautiful tradition. And there was a lot more interchange than people sometimes think. People would send, Soto teachers would send to Rinzai, students to Rinzai teachers, and vice versa. So the founder of our school of Soto Zen in Japan, his name was Eihei Dogen. Okay. As Japan started being hungry for Buddhist teachings from the mother country, the old country, they would take this very perilous journey to China, across the sea. It was very dangerous, and many people died. And so this was in about 1200. So this is a long time after Buddha was born, you know. So they would travel to, and Dogen did this. He traveled to China, and he went to all kinds of monasteries. And his question was, the teaching at the time was, we're already enlightened. We are already endowed with awakening. Already. You don't have to create it. You can't create it. So his question was very simple. If we're already endowed with Buddha nature, if we're already endowed with them, why practice? Right? It's a good question. Simple question. So he followed that question to China and found a teacher and as he said, solved the question of his lifetime. So he, studying Dogen is like studying poetry. He was a brilliant teacher. And there's no end to uncovering his teachings. But we'll be coming back and forth. We'll be going back and forth and revisiting his teachings every once in a while. I'll be kind of throwing things out there. But if you're interested, I suggest you read some Dogen. Oh, one thing you might want to know that I found interesting is that according to the best historical records that we have, the first ordained Buddhist monastic in Japan was a woman. Mm-hmm. In 584, a woman traveled to Korea, because Zen Buddhism was in Korea before it was in Japan, to be ordained. And she was joined by two others. And so they were ordained and continued their studies until 587. And then they returned to Japan in 590. So that's kind of a fun fact. Zenshin. Zen mind. So all of these teachings that we're going to cover interweave and reflect one another. And we need patience. And humor, and risk to be changed. Please remember, Buddhism has no pope. There's no one that tells us what we have to believe. We just engage and figure out what works for us. We make it real. So the first teaching I'm going to talk about First of all, any questions, comments so far? Anything? I'll probably talk until around 10 or so, and then we'll open up the floor for more questions. But
are you going to tell us why he practiced?
What the answer was? That's what's called practice realization. The answer was, we practice because enlightenment is realized in practice. No place else. It's not something that you go and get. It's enacted moment by moment by moment in our practice. Contemporary Zen teacher Joko Beck said, there are no enlightened people, there are only enlightened moments. So that means our responsibility is to wake up in each moment, right? Because enlightenment's not some permanent state, and it's not some nice experience. Nothing to do with nice experience or not. Nice experiences are nice, they're great, they come along once in a while, okay. Then what do? Because the next moment is a moment of practice. So we call this Shuso Ito, practice realization, and I'll talk some more about that. But Dogen lost it's unclear who his father was, lost his mother at a very young age. And it's said that he really was deeply affected by the teachings of impermanence when he saw the smoke rise out as his mother after in his mother's cremation. Yeah. So, you know, as a young boy, he was really touched deeply by the need to figure out and to be alleviating suffering. That's what the Buddha taught. I teach suffering and the alleviation of suffering. So what does that mean? Yeah.
I just wondered, is Dogen the one who just sat in front in a cave in front of a wall for 30 years?
That's Bodhidharma.
Oh, okay.
So Bodhidharma, you'll see, I should have mentioned, I almost brought a picture. Bodhidharma, there's pictures of Bodhidharma. He's got these big eyebrows and these fierce eyes. It's like this. Well, what's interesting is that Bodhidharma was Indian, and he went to China, right? So one of the reasons that he's drawn with these giant round eyes is because the people in China, he did have these giant round eyes, you know. But he's very fierce. And he climbed over, you know, the Himalayas. He went from India to China. Can you imagine? There was a lot of going back and forth. And the translations that happened in China at first were very rough translations. And it took a long time for them to really, really get it. And it's one of the reasons why there's confusion, because they were using Taoist terms to talk about Buddhist principles. And so it all got kind of mixed up, creatively mixed up. That's what's happening here now, only a lot faster because we have all this technological stuff. But we're babies here. We're babies. We're just starting to learn. So, yeah. That was Bodhidharma. And he did. He sat for many years in a cave facing the wall. Anything else? Okay, let's talk about emptiness, shall we? Okay. I hope I brought my emptiness notes. They're empty. They're somewhere sitting at my desk at home. I don't think so. Oh, yes, here we go. Okay, what do you all think emptiness means? Means this? Mm-hmm. Empty glass? Good, I get some no's. I'm really glad. Emptiness does not mean an absence of something. I think that the term emptiness, the translation of the Buddhist term shunyata, emptiness is probably the worst piece of translation that's ever been done in the history of humankind. My personal opinion. Because you, as Westerners, when we think empty, we think hollow, we think maybe like we have to fill something up. We think, sometimes we think this kind of existential, empty, angst feeling, meaningless, right? Or an empty glass. But emptiness means empty of inherent existence, okay? Empty of inherent existence. Same empty of separateness, empty of isolation, empty of aloneness. That's what emptiness means. Emptiness is the same as interdependence. Who said something about interdependence? Yeah. When we say emptiness, what we mean is that there is nothing you will ever find ever, ever, ever in the entire universe that ever was or ever will be that is separate from everything else. Okay? Never. You will never find it. Everything is completely related to everything else. So, interdependence and emptiness are two ways of talking about the same thing. Okay? Empty of permanence. You've heard of impermanence. Somebody else said impermanence here. Yeah. Impermanence means it's impermanence is easy to see if we look in the mirror, right? This face is not the face of me when I was 20 years old. It's easy to see when, you know, the car breaks down, or it's easy to see when the lettuce has gotten wimpy in the refrigerator. It's easy to see, right? It's harder to really look and see everything is moving so fast, changing so fast, moment by moment by moment by moment. You can't grasp onto anything. Buddha said, we suffer because we think things are permanent, and so we try and hang on to them. But they're not. We don't like that. I used to have a friend, when something would happen that he didn't like, he would say, but I don't want mustard on my hot dog. It's like that. You know, I don't want this. Well, guess what? That's the teachings. And the more we can accord with the teachings, the more we can absorb them and understand them and accord with them, the happier we are. The more at peace we are. Happy doesn't mean happy, happy all the time. It means a kind of settled joy and peace in our lives. Because we're living with fullness, the way things are. So empty of inherent existence means there are innumerable causes and conditions that come together to meet every moment. There are so many reasons why we're sitting here. Think about it. Everything that happened to you before you walked into this room. From the fact that your parents must have met someplace, to what you ate for breakfast, the fact that you were able to walk out your door, the mechanic that fixed your car or your bicycle, or the person that made your shoes. There are so many factors that come together to allow us to be in this moment. That's emptiness. That's interdependence. Okay? So when you hear the word empty, finish the rest of the sentence or the phrase. Empty of separateness. Empty of isolation. Empty of permanence. Empty of inherent existence. Inherent existence meaning isolated. Permanent existence. So in our day-to-day lives, we cling to what is, what we, what, oh, I want that to stay. Or I don't want that one. Sorry, not that one. Give me another one, please. But that's not the way life works, right? We don't, this is what is. And we have a choice. We act in choice. We're not, this is not, our fate is not determined. But our choice is, how are we going to practice with this moment by moment? How are we going to practice with this? How are we going to open our heart to this? How are we going to wake up to this? How are we going to engage with this? Are we going to be at war with reality? Or are we going to join with it and find our way? This is emptiness. One way that we, one example that I sometimes use is a cloud. So the cloud, many things come together to make a cloud, right? And one of the mistakes sometimes people make about the teachings of emptiness is they say, well, things don't really exist then. If they're all empty of inherent existence, something doesn't exist. But it exists. If the cloud rains, you get wet, right? That's not theoretical. It's real. But we investigate emptiness deeply. We investigate and we say, yes, everything in essence is a dynamic relational reality. Okay? You cannot find an essence of anything, a fixed essence of anything. Everything fundamentally is a dynamic relational reality. And you're you, and I'm me, and we're real. That door might be dynamic relational reality and me too, but if I try and walk through it without opening it, I'll hurt myself. So this is what's sometimes called the two truths. Relative and absolute, conventional, ultimate, whatever you want to say. They fit together like this. They're never separate. Everything is all the time, always dynamic relational reality. And also absolutely unique and real in this moment. And changing. Boom, 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 boom. So, who cares, right? I mean, really, what difference does it make? You know, what is that called when it gets home at night? You know? That's what we have to look at. And the thing about the teachings of emptiness, in the Buddha Dharma, we say it's not. We don't teach this just because it's true. We believe it's true. We, you know, according to the Dharma, if you look at reality, this is what you'll find. You know, that's just the way it is. It's just the way things are. We teach it because it changes us in positive ways. If we actually live our lives in a way where we understand moment by moment our intimate connection with everything else, what arises is gratitude. What arises is respect for others. What arises is kindness, curiosity. It changes us in positive ways when we actually engage with this. So any of the teachings that I give you, I hope that you will take them out and actually look at them and say, walking down the street, what happens if I actually engage with this person, this event, this moment, as both completely unique and a dynamic reality? See what happens. Because otherwise, who cares? It's just a theoretical observation that we can take out and play with, which is fine. We can do that with lots of things, right? But when we talk about the Dharma, we're talking about tasting things and seeing how they work for you. The correlate of this, too, is one dimension, another dimension of this, is that the teachings of emptiness are true for us, too. This is what's sometimes called the teachings of no self. you probably hear me say this over and over again, and for those of you that have been coming here regularly, you know, the teachings of no self do not mean that no self exists. Okay? The teachings of no self do not mean that no self exists. A self exists. You exist. I exist. We each have our unique history, our preferences, our talents and gifts and, you know, all of that. The teachings of no self mean we're not a permanent, fixed, essential self. You will never find a soul, according to Buddhism. You will never find an essential element of you that is separate from and not related to everything else. We also are completely interconnected with all of reality. Who we are has arisen from many, many, many dynamic forces, and we are who we are because of those. So this no self means no separate eternal self, no separate essential self. And again, okay, what does that mean? It means that when we walk down the street, we're completely intimate and connected with everything else, everybody else. The fact that I've met all of you today changes me. The fact that you've met everybody else in this room changes you. You may not even be aware of it. This is how we are. So gratitude arises from this. Compassion arises from this. Connection arises from this. Kindness arises from this. If you're really connected with someone and you understand your own fluidity and theirs, how can hate arise? You can, believe me. But how can we hang on to it? What happens to our relationships when we understand that we're intimately bound to all beings? We. And that we can change in a moment. This is the other thing, is in practice, we can turn on a dime. We're not bound by, we're impacted by, we're informed by, we're shaped by all that's come before, but we're not bound by it. Who we are can evolve and change, and we have responsibility for engaging with how that happens. Does this make sense? So this is what we mean by no self. So I'll read you a quote by Dogen, if I can find it here. Okay, listen to this. This is from the fascicle Zenki. Life is, for example, like people sailing in a boat. Although we set sail, steer our course, and pull the boat along, the boat carries us, and we do not exist apart from the boat. By sailing the boat, we make the boat what it is. Study assiduously this very time. At such a time, there is nothing but the world of the boat. The heavens, the water, and the shore all make the boat and make us. Hence, I make life what it is, and life makes me what I am. In riding the boat, one's body, the mind, and the self, and the world make this moment. They are together the dynamic function of the boat. The entire earth and the whole sky are in company with the boat's vigorous exertion. Such is the I that is life, and the life that is I. Do you hear that again?
Mm-hmm.
No. Life is, for example, like people sailing in a boat. Although we set sail, steer our course, and pull the boat along, we engage, we make choices, we are a unique self, we move forward. The boat carries us. Everything in our life carries us. And we do not exist apart from the boat. The boat isn't a boat unless it's sailing, right? It's dependent upon the water. It's dependent upon the sail. It can only be enacted as a boat with all of the factors coming together. By sailing the boat, we make the boat what it is. Study it assiduously this very time. This very time. Each moment is like this. The heavens, the water, and the shore all become the boat's time. Hence, I make life what it is. Life makes me what I am. In riding the boat, one's body and mind, the self and the world are all together the dynamic function of boat. And I would say person. Yeah. The entire earth and the whole empty sky are in company with the boat's vigorous exertion. Such is the I that is life and the life that is I. So what happens in our life if we experience ourselves in this way? This is a practice question for us to carry. What happens if we really experience ourselves as being made by and making all of the different dimensions in our life? What happens, do you think? Maybe a little bit more open, maybe a little bit more patient, maybe a little bit more engaged, maybe a little bit more flexible, more respectful. This is what we mean by the teachings of no self. So, another dimension of this is sometimes people think the teachings of no self mean we need to drop the self. We say drop. Have you ever heard that? Let go of the self or drop the self. Or anybody ever heard that? No? Yeah? Good luck. The self is not a problem to be solved. It's not an obstacle to be overcome. That's not what's going on here. We are creatures with selves. One of the ways I talk about the self is the organizing principle of our life. There is a location here. And it needs to figure out how to walk through that door. And as one of my teachers said, you need to know which mouth to put your fork in. I mean, we have to get real about this. You know, this is it, you know. We have to. We have to organize our reality coherently and consistently. And we need to, if we're going to say we're going to meet somebody at 12 o'clock for lunch, we need to show up. But what are the organizing principles of our lives? Is it rigidity and fear and clinging? If we study emptiness and no self, we have an opportunity to allow this kind of dynamic relationality and respect and generosity and gratitude infuse the organizing principles of our life. So we have a totally different experience then. We are a different self in a way. Yeah. We'd be willing. There's a really wonderful Buddhist philosopher named Jeffrey Hopkins. He talks about having a mind willing to change. A mind willing to change. A heart willing to change. Taking in these teachings allows us to have a heart and mind willing to change. So these are these two kind of really fundamental principles of emptiness / dependent co-arising interdependence, meaning everything, including you, which is the no-self part, is a constellation, is an arising of life, interdependent life in this moment. Constantly changing, dynamic, alive. Somebody said, what is Zen? Answer, it's alive. These teachings, if we allow them to infuse us, change how we live our life. They encourage us to be awake. Right? They encourage us to seek out ways to be awake, which is practice. Right? One of the ways I talk about practice is that which we do which deepens our ability to enact the teachings. That which we do which deepens our ability to enact the teachings. Sitting meditation, walking meditation. Walking meditation is really good to do. You can do it formally, or you can do it while you're walking down the street. Nobody even knows you're doing it. You don't have to have a special look on your face. Just walking down the street. Awareness, connection.